me, Colin.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, August 24th, 2020. The GOP Trump Family Convention, available on a cable news channel near you, gets underway tonight. I know many people who are seeking alternative programming and others who plan to drink a lot as they watch. But sobering news, it was a bloody weekend for black men in America. In Lafayette, Louisiana, police killed Trayford Pellerin. They say he had a knife. He was entering a convenience store at a gas station. That was on Friday night. And then Sunday, in Kenosha, that's near Milwaukee, Wisconsin, cops shot Jacob Blake 7 times in the back. So far, he has survived. First to the Louisiana case, Trayford Pellerin, aged 31, was on foot as he left one convenience store. Officers who'd been called and told that he had a knife. They used tasers, which didn't appear to impede him. And as he moved along the street to another convenience store, it appears these were both at gas stations, he was shot and killed as he started to enter that store. Now, his family says that he may have been having a mental health crisis. But from the description, he posed no immediate threat to the officers. And the use of deadly force, again, based on what we know at this point, cannot be justified. And in the case in Wisconsin, I've seen a troubling video. And again, we have to rely on sketchy details that have surfaced so far. But what we are told that accompanies this video footage, where you see the 29-year-old Jacob Blake walk into the frame of the camera, across the front of a 4-door van, a minivan, and he's being followed by at least one police officer. There were 4 total on the scene, with guns drawn. And as Blake walks around the front of the vehicle, opens the driver's side door, an officer grabs the man's shirt, pulls him back, and we hear in rapid fire the discharge of 7 bullets into his back. All of this occurs in less than 20 seconds. Now, according to the early investigation over at Mint Press News by Alan McLeod, Blake was reportedly acting as a peacemaker at an incident trying to break up a fight between 2 women. But after police arrived, it appears they treated him as a suspect. They tased him. They drew their weapons. He walked toward his car, and 3 of his young children were inside that vehicle. And I see no display of weapons. I can't explain why Blake was not responding to the officer's vocalized commands. But the idea that he needed to be subdued by 7 shots to the back is outrageous. Blake falls forward into the car, leaning on the horn. He was taken for emergency treatment, and he is clinging to life in the Milwaukee hospital today. This prompted hundreds of people to protest in Kenosha. And I've been to that town. It's not far from Chicago, and people go there on the weekends. Democratic Governor of Wisconsin, Tony Evers, said tonight, Jacob Blake was shot in the back multiple times in broad daylight in Kenosha, Wisconsin. While we do not have all of the details yet, what we know for certain is that he is not the first black man or person to have been shot or injured or mercilessly killed at the hands of individuals in law enforcement in our state or our county. So it appears that police are not getting the message that a summer of rage on the streets of America should cause them to think about the use of deadly force. In these two instances, I think we'll regenerate the street protests, the Black Lives Matter demonstrations across the United States. And as Trump takes to the airwaves and he's going to speak every night at his convention, can you all say narcissistic supply? You can expect him to press his law and order agenda. And I believe that that expression is what gives these cops the license, the impunity, the sense that they have this power and they shouldn't be afraid to use it because Trump's got their backs. And there's another case that led to the firing of a police officer north of Atlanta in Gwinnett County, Georgia. It's northeast of Atlanta. A TikTok video captured a scene where Michael Oxford, the officer, was sent to an address where police believed that a launched bottle, a missile, had come from. And he encountered a woman who wasn't going to cooperate. Her name is Candesia or Candesia Smith. And so far, the police department is saying that they're firing Officer Oxford because he didn't use courtesy in arresting her. They're saying that this was a legitimate action on the part of the officer. He just didn't do it right. So he responded to what's called a property damage call. The officer was told over the radio that a bottle had been thrown at a car. So he went to a house where someone had been seen on a video picking up the bottle before the police arrived. He saw a woman who matched the description of the person in the surveillance footage who had picked up the bottle before the cops got there. He tried to speak to her but couldn't, he said, because Ms. Smith and others were yelling at him. And on a video posted on TikTok, you can hear Smith say, "I'm not going anywhere. You're on our property. We did not call you. I'm not going anywhere." So Oxford told Smith she was under arrest. He pulled at her. He used a taser to try to subdue her. He tried unsuccessfully to put a pair of handcuffs on her. And she yelled out, "Call the police, Mama," as she fell to the ground into a patch of bushes near the porch. On the video, Smith can be heard saying, "Don't touch me." Then an off-camera voice says, "You're on her neck. Do you not understand what you're doing?" Oxford, the cop, tells Smith to stop resisting. And near the end of the video, another white officer arrives and helps to handcuff Smith, and then they took her away. She was released, I can't quite tell how soon later, but she is now pursuing legal action. And on the streets of Portland Saturday, there was a protest launched by demonstrators who support the police. This led to a counter-demonstration calling out the Back the Blue rally attendees. And a lot of exchanges were made, some verbal, some with thrown objects. From two videos that I viewed, it appeared that the pro-cop demonstrators were packing those large bottles, spray bottles of pepper spray that you can shoot, you know, 4 or 5, even 7 feet from the nozzle of that bottle. And it was pretty interesting because from my observations, the police seemed most interested in containing the Black Lives Matter protests, but not the pro-cop protesters. Shocking, isn't it? So then on Sunday, after the news broke of Jacob Blake being shot in Kenosha, more than 300 protesters marched on a Portland police bureau, Northeast Portland, late on Sunday. Police issued verbal warnings. Then the awning of a building next to the police bureau was lit on fire. Then the officers used munitions, including tear gas, to scatter the crowd. The fire was quickly extinguished. And it was a change in the police response from just 2 days earlier, when lines of police officers intercepted a similar march before it even reached the precinct station. About 24 people were arrested on Sunday. And I still, from my long-distance perch here, believe that the Portland police are calling riot before the conditions actually exist so that they are justified in using tear gas and the projectiles. So around 10:30, the police declared an unlawful assembly in response to thrown objects and lasers shined at the officers. Now, I'm sorry, that's not a riot. It may be unlawful behavior, but I believe that they're quick with that trigger to call it a riot. At the World Socialist website, a report I haven't seen anywhere else, that Facebook last week, on Wednesday, published an update to its, quote, dangerous individuals and organizations, end quote, policy, labeling left-wing and anarchist organizations as violent and falsely comparing them with fascist militia groups, right-wing extremists, and those associated with QAnon. In a newsroom blog post entitled An Update to How We Address Movements and Organizations Tied to Violence, Facebook says that it is taking action against pages, groups, and Instagram accounts tied to offline anarchist groups that support violent acts amid protests, U.S.-based militia organizations, and QAnon. And as we know, we have no evidence of organization when it comes to anarchists. So just by very nature to call them anarchist groups. Now, maybe they're Facebook groups of people who are interested in anti-fascism and anarchy. But they seem to be falling into that trap that has been defined by Trump. And the standards that they articulate are arbitrary and subjective. The policy includes organizations and movements that have demonstrated significant risk to public safety, but do not meet the rigorous criteria to be designated as a dangerous organization and banned from having any presence on our platform. So who is deciding this? The fact-checkers from the Atlantic Council who populate Facebook management? And here are some examples of sites that have been shut down in the present Facebook dragnet. A site called It's Going Down, an anarchist news publishing platform that reports on social struggles and exposes the activities of white supremacist and neo-Nazi networks. That sounds like First Amendment speech to me. Crimeth, Inc., a left-wing and anarchist publishing organization that identifies as an international network of aspiring revolutionaries. Then there's the PNW Youth Liberation Front, a group that says it is a decentralized network of autonomous youth collectives dedicated to direct action towards total liberation. And they have been active on the streets of Portland. Again, unless they are openly advocating or organizing violent action, these appear to be protected expressions to yours truly. So we are in an era of true repression. And Trump is stoking it, and so are his Republican allies, who control legislatures and state houses in over 30 states, like Tennessee, where Governor Bill Lee has signed into law an upgrade to existing measures And the new law provides that demonstrators who camp on state property, like scores have been doing in front of the state's Capitol building since Memorial Day, can now be charged with a Class D felony. Previously, it was just a misdemeanor. And the impact of this is if you are convicted of a Class D felony, you lose your right to vote. So these are really repressive methods. Now, I haven't seen any coverage that indicates that the protesters in Nashville are crossing any particular lines. They may be a nuisance, but it doesn't seem anything like the chop in Seattle. And Trump hasn't threatened to send his Royal Guard, the stormtroopers, into Nashville to clear it out. Meanwhile, the Trump family, which will be front and center, almost half of the speakers at the Republican online convention, are members of the Trump family. And chances are they aren't going to mention the latest love notes that they've gotten from the Attorney General of the State of New York and the Manhattan District Attorney. Because the Attorney General has filed a statement that they're investigating the Trump Organization's use of statements of financial condition. And, of course, it was Michael Cohen, who's working on that tell-all book, the former lawyer and fixer for Trump, who told us that they inflated the numbers when they wanted to impress Forbes magazine and get on the world's richest men list. And they reduced the numbers when it was time to pay the tax man. That is fraud and manipulation. And Eric Trump, the second brother, who is often mischaracterized or cartoonized as the idiot brother, and he does look the part, he had scheduled to be interviewed in the investigation in late July, but he abruptly canceled that interview. Now, the Supreme Court has already rejected President Trump's claim that he has immunity. And certainly, Don Jr. and Eric have zero immunity from legal actions, either civil or criminal, while Daddy is the president. So, the filing today mentions valuations of three Trump properties, a golf course in Los Angeles, an office building on Wall Street, and a country estate I have never heard about called Seven Springs in Westchester County, New York. And the claim is that the valuations are manipulated for the benefit of whoever is going to be reading those reports. And about the only Trump family members who will not be speaking and are not invited to the Trump Love Convention are niece Mary and the Donald's older sister, Mary Ann Trump Barry, a retired federal judge. And the niece, Mary, has revealed that she secretly recorded 15 hours of conversations with Judge Barry. And she released those. We're not told if Marianne Trump Barry approved of the release, but I can't imagine she did. Anyway, she says her little brother Don is cruel. You can't trust him. She accused him of being phony, of lying, of having no principles. She expressed shock about his tweeting, his lying, his lack of preparation. And here's the juicy quote. It's interesting. I was smoked into the house yesterday because of the wildfires here in California, and I had CNN on looking for coverage of the tropical storm / tornadoes that are bearing down on the Gulf Coast. And the first time they played this clip, they bleeped out the last two words, or actually just the last word, shit. And then the second time when Wolf Blitzer was anchoring, they played it without a bleep. Here it is, unbleeped. His goddamn tweeting and lying, oh my God. This is Judge Trump, Judge Barry. I'm talking too freely, but you know, the change of stories, the lack of preparation, the lying, holy shit. She went on to say that she knew that Donald had paid a friend to take his SATs to get into college, and she claims she even knows the man's name. Now, later we're told that she identified the brainiac who took the exam for Trump as Joe Shapiro, but Joe Shapiro apparently has expired, and his widow denied that he took that test. And Trump's response? Every day it's something else. Who cares? And he was asked, of course, about his sister, and he changed the subject to his brother who died a week ago. I miss my brother, and I'll continue to work hard for the American people. Not everyone agrees, but the results are obvious. Our country will soon be stronger than ever. Well, she described and he delivered. More lies, more twisted statements, more bullshit. And the brain behind some of Trump's bullshit is leaving the White House. Super blonde Kellyanne Conway has seen her family just crumble. And apparently the last straw for her 15-year-old daughter, Claudia, who has her own online following, Instagram, Twitter. Well, Claudia went public over the weekend, saying that after she learned that her mama, Kellyanne, had been given a speaking position at the Trump family convention, that she was planning to apply for emancipation. And she doesn't let her dad, George, off the hook either. So she's describing a very abusive family situation. And so Kellyanne has announced that she will soon be leaving the White House. And for once, it appears that the claim that she needs to spend more time with her family is actually true. Those are not alternative facts. And to be fair, I don't wish this on anyone. I think that Kellyanne Conway is a very shallow person who will say whatever Donald Trump wants her to say. I don't know how she and George have survived this with him tweeting, with him working on the Stop Trump Republican Light campaign. He's resigned from that, by the way, and it appears that the daughter has agreed to go off social media for a while. And I hope they can heal, and I hope that the daughter, Claudia, recovers from the political trauma that she has experienced. And we're about to report a story that ordinarily I would just put in the recycle bin. But because of the deep hypocrisy of some of the Christianists in this country, led by Jerry Falwell Jr., I believe it's important to expose the religious posturing that conflicts so deeply with his private life. Because Jerry Falwell issued a 1,200-word statement to a friendly right-wing news outlet, the Washington Examiner. Falwell Jr. is on suspension from his post as the president of Liberty University that his daddy started. And you know that recently there was this weird photo that he posted of himself and a young woman, and both of them were wearing shorts that were unzipped and open to the point where it looked like they had just taken them off or hastily put them back on. Well, now we get the deeper story, because Jerry exposes that his wife had a years-long affair with somebody who's been described as the pool boy, an ambitious young man who was working at our hotel and was saving up his money to go to school. And Falwell's wife, Becky, apparently fell for him. Jerry writes it up this way. Shortly thereafter, Becky had an inappropriate personal relationship with this person, something in which I was not involved. Well, we're going to check on that statement in a moment. It was nonetheless very upsetting to learn about. After I learned this, I lost 80 pounds. People who saw me regularly thought I was physically unwell. when in reality I was just balancing how to be most supportive of Becky, who I love. So you lose 80 pounds? While also reflecting and praying about whether there were ways I could have been more supportive of her and given her proper attention. Falwell said that he and Becky have forgiven each other. Her ex-lover, on the other hand, became increasingly angry and aggressive when they tried to distance themselves from him. The man, according to Falwell, started threatening to publicly expose their affair unless Falwell and his wife paid him off. And at the advice of their attorney, they initially stayed in contact and tried to placate him. But when they fully cut ties, or tried to, Falwell says, the man ramped up his threats to disclose more outrageous and fabricated claims about us. Over the course of the last few months, this person's behavior has reached a level that we've decided the only way to stop is to go public. So on Monday, a former business partner, Giancarlo Granda, gave an interview to Reuters in which he said that he had an affair with Becky Falwell, which involved Jerry Falwell watching them have sex. He denied any attempt at blackmail. Becky and I developed an intimate relationship, and Jerry enjoyed watching from the corner of the room. Now, this brings me to another kind of uncomfortable statement that I'm nevertheless going to make. I always found it bizarre that in the early days of the Trump takeover of the White House, led by Steve Bannon, one of the favorite insults that they would toss around carelessly was the word cuckold, and the short form, cuck. And what is being described here is Jerry Falwell Jr. as a cuckold. I mean, I guess a voyeur as well, if he was in the room when his wife was shtupping, allegedly, the pool boy. And I just find this so bizarre, because these are the holier-than-thou evangelicals who impose, dress codes at Liberty University. Skirts can be no more than 2 inches above the knee, and you're not allowed to wear shorts in a classroom. Don't want to get the opposite sex too excited. And so they cling to the kind of standards that Mike Pence has taken to ridiculous extremes. He won't have dinner with a woman other than his wife. And with the cloak of extreme Christianity, they visit such amoral horrors on the rest of us and impose their religious values on people who don't want them. And that's why I feel the need to share this sordid story with you in all its tawdry details. Well, here's another use of alternative facts. The Attorney General, Bill Barr, and personal lawyer to the president, told a TV interviewer over the weekend that he is vehemently opposed to any attempt to pardon former National Security Agency contractor Ed Snowden. And, of course, he employs falsehoods to promote his point of view. Quote, he was a traitor. That's not true. And the information he provided our adversaries greatly hurt the safety of the American people. There is no evidence of that. He was peddling it around like a commercial merchant. Well, that's not true either. From what we know, and we don't know all the details, only a tiny sliver of the files that Ed Snowden purloined from servers when he was given that security clearance by the NSA, only a tiny portion has been made public. And I've repeatedly used the example that on the slides, the PowerPoint slides related to the PRISM program, we saw 5 or 8 to begin with, and then another dozen at the most were dribbled out. And we're told there were a total of some 45 slides in that one package. And we've never gotten a definitive account of how many files Ed Snowden gave to Glenn Greenwald. And I'm still pissed at Greenwald because he's moved on. We don't know the status of the files that Snowden delivered to Greenwald. and the selective release leads us to wonder, you know, what they decided couldn't be published and why. Someday I'd like to know, sooner than later. So Twitter has done it once again. They have flagged a presidential tweet. They have covered it with a statement that it, we placed a public interest notice on this tweet for violating our civic integrity policy, for making misleading health claims that could potentially dissuade people from participating in voting. So what Trump said was that it's Democrats who want to use drop boxes where people can deliver their ballots, their mail-in ballots, without worrying about slow delivery by the partially demolished U.S. Postal Service. And then Trump added quite gratuitously, especially from him, that nobody could tell him that the drop boxes were being sanitized to prevent people from catching COVID when they dropped their mail-in ballot. Now, of course, this is preposterous, because there are two types of drop boxes. One where there's just a slot that you put it through, and you don't necessarily have to touch any surface in order to do that. And the other is the traditional mailbox where you pull a handle down to open the door, you drop your correspondence in there, and then you close the door. You can easily cover your hand with a Kleenex, with gloves. And, of course, you can sanitize your hands immediately after you make your delivery. So it's totally preposterous. It's just part of the fear-mongering. Here's the full quote. And let me point out, he's going to blame Democrats for this. But election officials are nonpartisan. And while in some jurisdictions that are all Democratic, you can say, whether he or she admits to being a Democrat, we know they are. But the bottom line is that I believe that most election officials in this country are honorable, and they attempt to operate in a nonpartisan way. So here's his tweet. So now the Democrats are using mail drop boxes, which are a voter security disaster. Among other things, they make it possible for a person to vote multiple times. Also, who controls them? And are they placed in Republican or Democrat areas? They are not COVID sanitized. A big fraud. Well, it's about time Twitter did something about the constant lying of Trump. But for them to limit it to issues related to COVID and election integrity is stupid. And it's an insult to all the people who have been either temporarily or permanently banned from the Twitter platform. Now we're learning that after an unusual Saturday session of the House of Representatives, led by Democrats, the vote was 257 to 150 to fund the post office with $25 billion, and the language basically directs the Postal Service to restore the status quo ante, all of the systems that were in place before Louis DeJoy took over, which was just around 70 days ago. So the Postmaster General was back on Capitol Hill, I believe, in person today at the House Oversight Committee. And at times, it's described, he got pretty pissed off. At times, shouting over his Democratic questioners, he criticized the false narrative that he was being promoted. Oh, he said was being promoted, about both his intentions and the changes. And he says he reduced overtime, he ordered the trucks leave as scheduled, and that he has no agenda to impact the election. Quote, I am not engaged in sabotaging the election. We will do everything in our power and structure to deliver the ballots on time. Now, he did acknowledge that it's not helpful to have Trump connect these changes at the post office, which he claims are so innocent, with Trump's effort to impose chaos on voting by mail. So when Steve Lynch, a Democrat of Massachusetts, accused DeJoy of incompetence and asked, how can one person screw this thing up in just a few weeks? Well, DeJoy got pretty heated. And in the end, Ro Khanna, Democrat from Silicon Valley, pressed DeJoy and said, well, look, if we get you $1 billion, would you reinstall those sorting machines and put it all back together? And DeJoy basically claimed that he knew the fix is in at the Senate and this bill's going nowhere. The House bill passed on Saturday. And DeJoy said, you're not going to give us $1 billion. You have no way of getting us $1 billion. We haven't been funded in 10 years. You can't pass any legislation. Well, that's not really true because there's $10 billion in the CARES Act from April that has not been released to the post office because they're not low enough on money to meet Steve Mnuchin's criteria. So Khanna would not relent, and a visibly exasperated DeJoy declared, get me the billion, and I'll put the machines in. And Khanna said, I'll take that as a commitment. And once again, we have the unusual scene of a live hearing on Capitol Hill, and the president, who is being trashed, is tweeting trash at the hearing. Here's what he said on the Twitter. All the radical left Democrats are trying to do with the post office hearings is blame the Republicans for the fraud that will occur because of the 51 million ballots that are being sent to people who have not even requested them. That's a lie. They are setting the table for a big mess. So it's a really disgusting scene. And we learned a little bit more about the cronyism involved because the chair of the Postal Service's Board of Governors, and that's an independent entity. The president doesn't have, and no politician, has the right to appoint the Postmaster General. Only the Board of Governors can do that. So what do? They packed the Board of Governors with loyal Republicans. And Duncan, the chair, said that Louis DeJoy's name was not even on the list of 53 candidates to be the next Postmaster General. But Duncan added it. Now, you can argue that DeJoy does have 20, 30 years of experience. I saw a brief clip of AOC interrogating DeJoy and asserting that the work he did over the years does qualify him as an expert on transport and logistics. But he also has a conflict of interest because the former company still pays him rent for certain facilities, and they do business with the Postal Service. And in a Sunday front pager, the New York Times reveals that Steve Mnuchin had a meeting in early February with two Republican members of that Board of Governors. The two Democrats were not invited. Do you wonder why? One of them, Dave Williams, has quit in protest over this whole sequence of events. But that's when the fix was put in by Mnuchin to make a dramatic shift in the management of the Postal Service. Yesterday, like a tsunami crossing the Pacific, word reached me first from Mark in Melbourne and then in the very next email from John Zwiebel in Hawaii that there is a fresh episode of the Honest Government satirical videos about the U.S. Postal Service.
Hello, I'm from the United States Postal Service. For more than 200 years, you've counted on us to deliver your mail on time. Neither rain, nor snow, nor sleet, nor hail has kept us from doing our job. But now, for the first time in history, there's something that does. Bullshit. Introducing our new Postmaster General, appointed by the President himself. Does he have experience in running a postal service? Of course not. But he has many years' experience in donating millions of dollars to these guys. That's what makes him perfectly qualified for running the Postal Service. off a fucking cliff. In just a few weeks, he managed to slow our deliveries down to a trickle, dismantle mail sorting machines across the country, fire and reassign our executives to sow confusion, and abduct mailboxes from your neighborhood.
Bullshit!
Thankfully, the bullshit was so egregious that it brought the nation together for once, forcing this stooge to back off. For now. Bullshit doesn't just hinder the brave workers of the Postal Service, many of whom have given their lives to keep delivering mail during a deadly pandemic. It also makes it harder for you to vote in the coming election. An election in which millions more will use mail-in ballots to avoid standing in line for hours at a polling station during a deadly pandemic. Does mail-in voting favor one party over another? No. In Colorado, where most people voted by mail, Republicans flipped a Senate seat and won a majority in the state Senate. Is it open to fraud? No. As this big sack of shit admitted under oath, there's no evidence for concern about mail-in ballot fraud. Even this coven of corporate edgelords has said so. Again, in states that mostly use mail-in voting, fraud affected only a handful of ballots out of millions cast.
So you can watch the full video, and I encourage you to, because the audio is powerful, but the pictures tell additional stories, and there's some great sight gags, too. And these are produced in Melbourne, Australia. Their knowledge of American politics that they convey is remarkable, and I really appreciate what they're doing. I also appreciate the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions, people like Ted Kelly, Brian Massey, Dick Attlee, who we'll get back to in a few minutes, and Billy Cook. They all chip in $5 or $10 a month to support my work. I appreciate that. You can do it, too. All you have to do is stop by peterbcollins.com/signup. And here in Northern California, we continue to be plagued by massive wildfires, affecting now more than 700,000 acres of property. Thousands of homes and other buildings have been destroyed. The death count is at 7. We currently have 250,000 people evacuated from their homes, and I've packed my go bag. We had predictions that there was going to be another electrical storm last night, but it didn't amount to much, and the firefighters are maxed out. We have gotten thousands of reinforcements from other states, and we're very grateful for that outside relief. But the fires, for example, we'll just run down the biggest ones for you. 542 square miles, the SCU Lightning Complex fire, and that is Silicon Valley and the East Bay. 347,000 acres at 10% containment. The LNU Lightning Complex fire, Napa, Sonoma, Solano, Lake, and Yolo counties, that is to my north and east. 22% containment on 350,000 acres, and the CZU Lightning Complex fire. That's the one along the coast of San Mateo and Santa Cruz counties. 8% containment, and the size of that is 115 square miles, or 74,000 acres. That's the fire that has reportedly done massive destruction to the historic Redwood Forest at the Big Basin State Park. And it's just tragic to see what we are losing here. And the air quality in the communities that are not afflicted by the fire is quite toxic. It gets worse during the day, and then the breezes and winds start to pick up in the afternoon, which improves our air quality but causes the fires to move even more rapidly. So today, I drove by my local public grade school, and the parking lot was full. There were teachers outside with directions for parents, and so it appeared that they're doing some classroom learning. But in many communities, it's all online. And today, for a four-hour period this morning, starting at about 9 o'clock Eastern, Zoom had a massive outage. Now, I understand the traffic there is incredible. So many people are relying on Zoom for one-to-one meetings and one-to-50 meetings. But we know that the online learning is defective in many ways. And I want to commend to you an article published late last week by a former producer of mine, Joshua Emerson Smith, worked for me when I was doing the syndicated radio show 11, 12 years ago. He went on to work for public radio up in Alaska. And for several years now, he's been a beat reporter at the San Diego Union-Tribune. And his article last week really got my attention because it's so personal. He wants to share with everybody who is in the same boat. He's got two kids, one entering first grade, the other kindergarten, and there is no classroom learning in his school district. And so his wife took advantage of a clause in the CARES Act and used her prerogative to claim 12 weeks of paid leave at two-thirds of her salary, up to $200 a day. But her 12 weeks is about to run out. And so Joshua has decided that he is going to take his turn, and for the next 12 weeks, he's going to stay home with his two young sons. And he even discloses here their relative salaries. His wife makes a little bit more than he does, but they're just going to be able to scrape by with the pared-back incomes. And they've decided that it's the best thing they can do for their boys. They've tried child care pods. They are discussing getting involved in a learning pod in their neighborhood. But these are all complicated, and they cost money at a time when incomes have sharply declined. So I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. And if you know parents who are in that situation, please share it with them, because I think I've seen no other publicity about this. I did not know that there is a special family leave, parental leave accommodation included in the CARES Act that was passed in April. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. First, we look at the numbers. 23.4 million worldwide cases reported, and the worldwide death toll is now in excess of 800,000. Across the United States, 5.7 million confirmed cases, 176,819 deaths, and in the last 24 hours, new cases been reported at the number of 34,000 and new deaths at 449. And on those new case reports, I am a little bit skeptical that we're seeing a reduction in testing that is not being widely reported, and I also think that the numbers could be manipulated by that company in Pittsburgh that's been hired by the Trump administration, I think, to do just that. Florida has the third highest number of coronavirus cases in the nation, behind California and Texas. Those three states together account for 32% of total U.S. cases. Florida has 27,000 new cases, 2,500 new hospitalizations, and 873 deaths in the past week. On Sunday, it reported almost 3,000 new deaths. And on Saturday, Florida had 4,300 new cases. So this is a declining trend. And I hope that we can see these numbers continue to go down. And someday we'll find a level of tolerance that we can all live with. Also in Florida, a report that a young girl from Putnam County died from COVID-19, 9-year-old Kimmy Lynham, who had no known history of underlying health care problems. 8 minors in Florida have died from the virus since March. The state reports just under 50,000 residents under 18 years of age who tested positive. So, you know, when you compare positivity to deaths, that is a relatively low ratio. NBC News reports that a Hong Kong man has been infected with the coronavirus for a second time. And you may recall it was months ago, I think it was in May, that we shared the news that here in California there's at least a single case of a woman, I recall it was in Riverside County, who was in the hospital for the second time after recovering from a fairly severe case of COVID-19. The findings suggest that some patients who recover may have only short-lived immunity from reinfection. And this case will also likely be significant for scientists who've been working on treatments using antibodies. The 33-year-old man in Hong Kong developed mild symptoms in late March when he was first diagnosed. That was on March 29th when he was hospitalized. The second infection occurred more than 4 months later, reportedly after the man returned to Hong Kong from Spain via the United Kingdom. The New York Times reports, and I watched Trump deliver this news on Sunday, that the Food and Drug Administration has given emergency approval for expanded use of blood plasma from patients who've recovered from COVID-19 to treat individuals who are now hospitalized with active cases. And it's very clear that this was a political decision at the FDA. Trump tweeted at them on Saturday that the deep state appeared to be holding up approval of this in order to cause him to lose the election. And this is a very dangerous trend. Now, the doctors who I've seen interviewed say that, look, this is it's a positive step, but it will also reduce data collection. And we haven't seen a real peer-reviewed blind study of the use of blood plasma on patients and at what stage of the onset of the illness it is most effective at. So I want to be clear in case you get the idea that my skepticism goes too far. I want good news. I want to hear that there are promising treatments that are in the pipeline. But when you see the obvious political play behind this announcement, you can't help but be skeptical in my view. In a letter referring to the approval, FDA Chief Scientist Denise Hinton said, COVID-19 convalescent plasma should not be considered a new standard of care for the treatment of patients. Additional data will be forthcoming from other analyses and ongoing well-controlled clinical trials in the coming months. And Trump's tweet on Saturday was this: the deep state or whoever over at FDA is making it very difficult for drug companies to get people in order to test the vaccines and therapeutics. Obviously, they are hoping to delay the answer until after November 3rd. Must focus on speed and saving lives. And then he used the handle of the head of the FDA. Oklahoma State University is tracking its students in great detail, recording their locations when they're signed onto campus Wi-Fi, where they swipe their student cards, where they are in attendance, where they make purchases on campus. So Big Brother is all over this, and it may help reduce the number of parties that we've seen on various campuses across the country that have led to positive test results and closing of dormitories. And I heard a nightmare story over the weekend of a family that has a freshman enrolled at UCLA. She hooked up with three other women to rent an apartment. Then they were told that they could have solo dorm rooms, so they got out of the lease for the apartment, signed up for the dorm rooms. And then last week, UCLA announced the dorms will be closed entirely. And so this kind of whiplash makes it very difficult for parents and students to plan, and it's a particular hardship for people on limited budgets who may have made a commitment to an apartment and only learned afterward that it'll all be distance learning that could have been done from home. And finally, from Linda's report, Chinese artist and activist Ai Weiwei has a new film telling the story of the January COVID-19 lockdown in Wuhan, China. Although now living in Europe, Ai remotely directed dozens of volunteers across China to create Coronation, a portrait of Wuhan's lockdown and of a country able to mobilize huge resources if at great human cost. And Ai said, the audience has to understand this is about China. Yes, it's about the corona lockdown, but it's trying to reflect what ordinary Chinese people went through. The film is available in the U.S. at Alamo On Demand and in other parts of the world at Vimeo's website. Ai Weiwei said he had hoped to show it at a film festival, but New York, Toronto, Venice, after expressing interest, have turned him down. He also said that Amazon and Netflix have rejected the movie. His impression is this was because many of these festivals want to do business in China, and they avoid topics that might anger Beijing. And I'll get to an effort to suppress a video about COVID that I oppose. Not the video, the suppression, in a moment. But two press releases came in the last 48 hours from Public Citizen. That's Ralph Nader's organization. The first relates to the FDA's decision. I'll read it. It's just two paragraphs. The FDA's decision to grant an emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma on the eve of the Republican National Convention represents the most blatant politicization of FDA decision-making in history. Such action seriously damages FDA's credibility during the greatest public health crisis in 100 years, and this does not bode well for future FDA decisions. Then there's a much more positive memo from Public Citizen issued today. The National Institutes of Health will expeditiously conduct preclinical studies of GS441524 as a treatment for COVID-19 and will make the results readily available to the scientific community as requested by Public Citizen. Along with two university-based drug researchers, Public Citizen urged Gilead Sciences, the profiteering drug manufacturer, and several government agencies to advance development of GS, and you know the numbers, as a potential treatment for COVID-19 because evidence shows it may offer significant advantages over the closely related antiviral drug remdesivir. So we will follow that one closely. So I want to acknowledge a series of emails from our friend and supporter, Olivier de Mirlot. He is, I believe, a Swiss national. He told me he's currently spending time in the Netherlands. And he has been challenging me over my humanist argument. And I've responded to some of his emails before. But in the most recent, he makes a pretty compelling argument that my call to try to save every single life possible is nice, but that I have to accept that people die every day. And he's right. The mortality rates, he cites them in Europe, are very real. And no matter what we do, lifespans, illnesses, long-term infirmities, they all contribute to the ultimate death of each and every one of us. And the overall global mortality rate is 7.7 people per 1,000 inhabitants per year. In the United States, it's a few percentage points higher at 8.3. He says, in response to my arguments about the untrustworthy statistics, he said, yes, it can be argued both ways that reported mortality rates are being adjusted for political or commercial ends. And this is where total mortality comes to the rescue, because we can compare monthly mortality week by week to historical averages. I haven't been able to find very clear graphs for the USA, but for Europe, the situation is clear. He said there was a peak in mortality. It was about 50% higher than previous year's winter's peaks. It's gone, and there's no observable second wave of mortality whatsoever. So I do accept the statistics. And then he seeks to place this into context. He says, my point is that if you accept what you call the humanist argument, then you would have had to been on red alert for the last 200,000 years, because normal mortality rates on the whole are also very high in absolute terms. They are, however, very low in probability terms. Your personal probability of dying next week is small. So then he says, having put the problem in perspective, it's time to put the policies in perspective and assess the proportionality of the measures compared to the problem. And I have to, in many respects, yield to Olivier's argument. But of course, I have a but. And that is that the public health measures that we took, as extreme as they are, with the economic impacts that are devastating, they have reduced mortality, because when this first hit, We didn't know how severe the rate of transmission would be. We didn't really understand the points of transmission. We do know much more now. But I continue to argue that even at the cost to our economies, that I prefer the actions that have been taken, more or less, as opposed to the idea that we just should have done nothing. Now, Olivier also sent me an article from the BBC. Actually, this one is from a different website. I apologize. RCINet. It's a French network. It's dated April. And it says, the projection is that the number of people suffering from acute hunger will nearly double to 265 million this year unless governments and private companies step in. And he's not making a black and white case that, you know, we deal with one or the other. But I argue that when you compare hunger versus COVID, that hunger is a reflection of the lack of political will to address the problem, to redistribute wealth, to achieve a lack of food insecurity, or what we would call food security, for the vast majority of the world's population. That hunger is an expression of greed, and that the response to COVID-19, if we factor out the profiteering, I believe is similar in nature. Finally, today I'm going to take a couple of minutes here to respond to Dick Attlee from Maine. And he makes an argument that related to school reopenings, that he considers children to be nearly invulnerable, and that hydroxychloroquine, which of course has been was temporarily approved and then that approval was withdrawn by the FDA. And I remain on the fence about HCQ. I was initially put off because of Trump's promotion of it, and I have admitted that. But I've read reports, and I have been treated to friendly arguments from many listeners, and I try to remain open-minded about the use of hydroxychloroquine. Now, in addition, Dick sent me a link to Plandemic 2, and number one, I want to strongly assert that I object to the suppression or the censorship of Plandemic 1 or Plandemic 2. And I believe that YouTube has already banned this hour-and-a-half documentary, and that is flat-out wrong. I also will say that in the long line of agitprop, and agitprop is not a dirty word in my vocabulary, but that's what this is. It is the equivalent of a Michael Moore movie that marshals the arguments, the pictures, and the sound bites that support the contention of the filmmaker. And I remain unconvinced about the case of Judy Mikovits. Was she arrested and charged in order to silence her? I don't know. And this film includes some brief clips with Judy Mikovits at the beginning of the film, and they still do not amount to proof. It is a counter-assertion about whether she was arrested and charged. And the first part of the film goes into attacking the media outlets that declared that the Plandemic 1 film was scurrilous misinformation and disinformation about COVID-19. And they single out John Oliver. I enjoy his Sunday night show on HBO, but I concede that he often takes a corporate or government line, particularly when it comes to conspiracy theories, and dismissing the ones that are found inconvenient. They go on at length about the false claims of fact-checking organizations from Poynter to Snopes. And I don't think that those are bad arguments. They also touch on my bias, feed my bias. When they talk about the 1979 patent law change, the Bayh-Dole Act, that allowed federally funded researchers to profit on the research that taxpayers were funding. And this involves patenting diseases and all of the treatments and vaccines that are developed to address them. They also focus on a simulation called Event 201 that took place in 2019. And this is eerily similar to many of the events like the Boston bombing, the San Bernardino shootings that were, running concurrently with war games or planning meetings, these kinds of simulations of these types of events. So I have to say that there are some points of persuasion in this new film. I am aware that the head of the World Health Organization, Tedros, from Ethiopia, has a really sordid history. But then they link him to Bill Gates and the Clinton Foundation without providing actual evidence from the field of what they claim has occurred from that collusion. And one of the flaws in the film is that they present arguments that I don't believe they prove. And part two of the film begins a takedown of Bill Gates. And there's a lot to take him down for. I have never been a fan of Bill Gates. But exposing Bill Gates does not prove that Judy Mikovits and her claims are accurate. And that's the pivotal point that I picked up in watching this film. I also thought that they manipulated us with B-roll. B-roll are the pictures that they show while a narrator makes statements. And maybe there's a website where I can look up the origin of some of the B-roll that they used. But as I watched, I felt myself reacting to the disjointed nature of the emotional pull of certain B-roll with the claims that the narrator was making. And so I come away, moved a little bit in their direction, but I also find that some of the claims are a reach, and I will continue to research these and offer my views as time goes on. Thanks for listening to my Daily News and Comment podcast all the way here to the end. I'll be back at you again tomorrow, same time, same website. You can share this all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.